All right.
All righty. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is March 8th, 2017. Colleagues, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5534, the Public Employee Retirement System. Steve, why don't you come on up? And I think, are we on day three now? Day two.
Just three. Seems like day 30. You said three.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Week five. Welcome.
Title day two.
Day two.
Because this is day two of my budget presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Steve Rodman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement System. Today's discussion will focus on our actual budget requests for 17-19 and give you a little background about the drivers of our system and how they lead to the impact on our budget. So just a little historical perspective on our legislatively adopted budget. This is just information that shows the progression from one biennium to the next. Not a lot of change as we go through this. In other words, we've been in a pretty stable staffing and budget environment for the last several biennia. Budget comparison from 15-17 to 17-19 shows that we're increasing some $2.2 million in our ask for 17-19, and the puts and takes are listed there on the left of the slide. Salaries are going up, as well as other personal expenses and adjustments. Big drop in services and supplies, and that has to do with predominantly with an allocation that was assessed to our agency for support of the Salem State Data Center. They changed the allocation model, and that allocation has dropped off of our budget. So that was a large share of what drove up our administrative expenses in this biennium, and that was the slide I showed you yesterday on the measurements as far as where the administrative expenses went higher than our target.
Mr. Chair, I want to come back and visit this on two levels. One of them is you were assessed the state data center, but you're not there, right?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, that's correct. Our physical plant is not located there. We do share some of the services, like the exchange is hosted through the central data center, so our emails and such are hosted through their services.
Okay.
If I may complete
please.
The answer, the assessment model changed to being one based on the agency's budget. It was because, and consequently, our share of that grew dramatically, as our budget is such a big share of state government. As I say, then they changed back to the assessment model. So this biennium, that does not show up. Our actual assessment went down quite a bit.
You're making my point, and I'm really using this as sort of a rhetorical forum to complain about the state data center. We make these sort of knee-jerk decisions about how stuff is going to work in that place. We haven't made the whole floor live. We've got security issues. We're going to now do it based on budget, and you're handling a gazillion million dollars. We don't have a plan for that facility, and I have sat in this same room and whined and fulminated and snarled about the state data center, and I continue to look for Mr. Pettit to sort of give us a roadmap to the future. What's it going to take to get that place off my loser list? And I just don't have an answer. And so I'm less talking to you than I am out there in agency land and hoping maybe Ms. Koba is listening or Mr. Pettit is listening. And every single budget that all of us sit on is coming in talking about their next IT project. I don't know about the ramifications of any of those IT projects having an interface with the data center. I'm terrified that you, with relatively good security, are going to be forced onto a platform that has vulnerabilities. I don't know how many $100 million we've spent on that thing, and we didn't bother to electrify the whole floor. I mean, I could just go on and on and on complaining about what a failure I think that operation has been. The mass is ended. You may go in peace. I'm finished.
On that note, please continue.
Thank you. Co-Chair Smith. So anyway, as you can see, we've got a slight increase going into our governor's budget for the 17-19 biennium. And the other point I want to make on budget comparisons is one we haven't shown you before, and it's just to resolve maybe some of the concerns or questions that we often raise, and that is what is PERS, and particularly what is it in relation to some of the DAS programs. So what I've shown here are a comparison of PERS to other state agencies. The green is PERS, and up until the split with DHS, between DHS and OHA, which occurred in the 11-13 biennium, we were second, and we're still second, although DHS is larger. We're just a little bit bigger than OHA in terms of the budget of the state of Oregon that we represent. And this is, of course, through, as LFO explained, our non-limited budget and the benefit payments that we do make.
Senator Johnson.
No.
No?
I'm done. I'm going to be quiet for a while.
So we continue to have discussions and continue to have questions related to our status in relation to other agencies, and this is an illustration of where PERS is a large player in terms of the state budget, but we're a 360 or so member agency, so are we big or are we little? We kind of go back and forth with that in our relationship to other agencies. It does make some of our requests, some of our dynamics a challenge. So now just some charts to show you the efficiencies and the direction that we see the dynamics of our agency evolving. This is our tier. This is broken out by our Tier 1, Tier 2 programs and our other programs that will identify. The green bars show you, again, the non-limited budget. And this is, again, for the Tier 1 and Tier 2 program. As you can see, that non-limited budget is projected to grow over the next several biennia as more and more Tier 1 members and Tier 2 members retire. That's why the green line is growing, because that's our retired population. And, of course, the red line is our active and inactive members, and that will decline as they transition from active or inactive status to retired status. Another interesting driver in our agency has to do with our work with our members. Does it begin when they come into public employment? Does it begin when they retire? And our experience, I think, mostly has been that you would think once we get to a retirement date and the member starts receiving their benefit that our relationship with them ends. I think really it only begins, because that's when we start getting into things like payment adjustments, address changes, the kinds of things that are labor intensive and engagement intensive. So the growth that you see here in the number of retired members, to me, portends that we will have more transactions with our members as they go into retirement rather than fewer transactions. And by transactions, I mean letters, emails, phone calls, just interactions with individuals. Quite a different view in OPSERP, of course. This is the new program. So, yes, unbelievably, there have been benefit payments out of this program. Not much, but some. And the scale's different, but at least the trajectory on the bars is the same. So you see that purple line that's just barely visible at the bottom. That is our number of OPSERP retired members. And even though it has a higher retirement age of 65, we have people in state service that have served their 5 years to vest in a retirement or reached that retirement age and started receiving an OPSERP benefit. So the dollar numbers you see there, too, are also going up. This, of course, has the red line being the active and inactive members growing, because those are the members or the people that are coming into public employment that are going to be filling up in this program. The individual account program we talked about a little bit yesterday. This is where the 6% member contribution is placed ever since 2004. Again, we see a projected increase in the non-limited budget because more that account balance is becoming a more and more relevant portion of members' retirement. whereas in the first couple of years, we refer to it as the red truck fund, where people would retire and buy a red truck because that's about how much money was in there, and that was their retirement present to themselves. Now this is getting to be real money, and it is going to be increasingly important to members who need this leg of their stool to support their retirement. So you can see, again, the growth in the number of members, because everyone coming in as an IAP member as well as an OPSERT member, you can see the growth in the non-limited budget spiking up over time. The retirement health insurance program, this is, again, out of a reflection of our non-limited budget in this area. So membership is creeping up, not as dramatically, of course, as OPSERP or the growth in public employers, but employees, I'm sorry. But this shows you that we expect as the population of retirees grows, more of those retirees will elect to come into our program. Just a little bit of background on this program. I touched on it a little bit yesterday, but the large share of the population in this program are the retired members who are in Medicare. So they passed age 65, they have enrolled in Medicare, and they are buying supplemental Medicare plans. And those supplemental Medicare plans are the kinds of plans that we negotiate with healthcare or health insurance providers, and members choose to carry on in the health insurance program and buy their Medicare supplement plans through the negotiations that we have made. Again, you get to relative size of populations. Our health insurance membership population is bigger than PEBS. We have more lives that we provide health insurance to than PEB does, because again, we cover everybody, and we have a very popular health insurance program we've managed to negotiate.
Yeah, Senator Johnson.
If you don't mind, I'd like to explore that a little bit further. And with an eye towards the, how many lives do you have?
So my recollection is some 57,000.
Okay.
I could be wrong, but it's around that.
The point that I'm getting at is a pathway to try to maximize the state's purchasing power in terms of the economy of the plans and the benefits of the plans, our purchasing power with respect to prescriptions. And I'm trying to figure out that if we looked at finding efficiencies in OEB, the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, and PEB, the Public Employees Benefit Board, we'd have maybe as many as 300,000 lives. I'm just kind of rounding that. You've got another 57. I don't know how your plans differ from OEB and PEB, but I'm trying to figure out why we have the state in three different lines of insurance that bifurcate that purchasing pool of trifurcated of lives, and why don't we put them together and get some real horsepower in the marketplace?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, the answer, at least as far as our health insurance program goes, is we are covering the Medicare-eligible population predominantly. So those are folks that have gotten to age 65 and
you say that as though that's a bad thing. I'm
just saying PEB and OEB are covering current employees. So they're a completely different insurance program.
So there would be no efficiencies, no upping the amperage of our buying power because your population is so discrete.
Correct.
Okay. Just casting about for additional lives, that's all.
The other point I want to, of course, emphasize about this health insurance program, if you look at other systems or other employers, you often hear concerns about the unfunded liability related to their health insurance programs. Those are programs where the employer has guaranteed to pay for the health insurance or has said, if you retire at this age, we'll pay for you up to Medicare. We don't do that here. All of this program is passing through the premiums through our hands and through our negotiations, so that a member's benefit payment is a piece is taken off to pay the premium for them in the health insurance program. So we don't have much liability associated with this program. The small slice that we do has to do with very minimal subsidies that we provide through statute for either state employees or for other participants in PERS, participating employers. But they're not significant, and those unfunded liabilities are recovered very quickly. Certainly not on the order of magnitude of the main benefit programs we've been talking about. So just a couple of charts to show you relatively why our budget is relatively stable, even in this environment where we have more members coming into the system and more members retiring out of the system. So this compares the number of members, which is the dotted red line above, to our number of FTE. You see a downward slope in our number of FTE and upward slope in the total membership. So we're holding steady, and again, this has to do with our technology investments that have allowed us to basically do more with less staff and to drive people into other alternative information sources like the web. All of this, of course, is with careful measure of and attention to our service levels to our members. We're not just slamming the door on them. We're giving them better tools. So their satisfaction level, again, with us, which is something we measure every year, stays relatively constant over time as well. Particularly positions in retirees, we have a declining, number of FTE to a rising number of retirees, pushing them once again to so many of the tools that we have online, such as verification of benefits or statements that they want. You want another copy of a 1099. Those kinds of things are all the sorts of things we try to automate and get retirees to drive to the web to resolve those. And lastly, of course, in relation to benefit payments, talk about doing more with less. The steep curve on the benefit payments, but again, the relatively flat level of the governor's budget and our positions that we have in relation to that. So generally pushing out quite a bit more money in resolution with just the same number of people to do that work.
So, Mr. Co-Chair. Oh, I'm co-chair today.
I did the same thing in my committee.
Did you? You can ask your own question.
So let me ask you this, and I want to use myself as an example. Yesterday, I visited with you about past state employment I had when I was in college. And this morning, you folks were extraordinarily responsive and shared with me what you had on record. And then it was shared with me, you'll need to go talk to your other employers. For me, that'll be a very easy phone call to make. And I'm sure, you know, our office will get a quick response. But what about that custodial worker who might have broken English, who has to make the same phone call? They're not going to get the same level of responsiveness. How do we help them?
Co-Chair Smith, that's an excellent question. Part of the answer to that has to do with raising the issues as early in the conversation as we can. So trying to, again, get members to first to realize that's probably a question they should ask. How much does PERS think I have worked for public employers? That's a great question to ask earlier than later. So we're trying to raise that awareness. Secondly, we try to let them have insight into what our records show. We've talked about our online member services and how members can go on and look at that sort of thing. If I may use your example, you would go online and you would not see any of the things that you think should be on there or wonder whether they are on there. And unfortunately, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is either because your employer never reported it, which as we later confirmed with you is the case. The other could be that your records, no offense, sir, may be so old we don't have records of them on the system.
Ouch. Lucky he didn't say that to me.
Ouch.
So I will shift from you as an example to me as an example, because as I shared with you, I have a time when I was working for the Department of Justice when I was in law school back in 1984-85. If I looked on online member services today, that information is not there. We have to dig for it. We have it. We know where it is, but you don't get to see it online. So
I guess, but here's my question. I understand a lot. My question is what are we doing to help that that hard state worker that's worked for us for 40 years who doesn't may not have the technical skill to go and do that research?
I was getting to that.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I got a little off case.
Okay.
But the point is, when that issue is raised, such as you raised with us, that's where we step into that role, and we will do that work. We will contact the employer when there is a dispute or a question about that record. And unfortunately, about all we can do is put the member and the employer together, because we don't have an independent. We will tell the member, this is what we think, or this is what we know. I'm sorry, this is what we know is your history. If you don't think that's right, you got to go talk to these people here.
So let me play that one further. What if is that where dispute resolution eventually comes into play, is if there's a disagreement between the two or they can't reconcile it correctly?
Yes, Co-Chair Smith, it definitely does. We've had situations where we've had all kinds of situations. We've had situations where the employers have no record to justify that. We've had circumstances where there was an exception, for example, student employment, where the work that the person did not qualify for PERS.
Or there's
any number of exceptions that have existed throughout some of our existence. We've had circumstances where members come in with their Social Security records and show all of this employment, and the employer goes, we don't have anything better, let's go with that. So it has become resolved in any number of ways. The challenge, of course, is going back so far in history, we have multiple data systems, employers have multiple data systems. We're often talking about pulling boxes out of the basement or out of Iron Mountain or wherever you might have stored, or, oh, we lost those in the flood. We've had all of that over our course of time, and the dispute resolution process does come into it. Our basic predicate in that sort of a dispute resolution is we pay benefits according to the employer's records, and if the employer is either the member can prove the employer wrong, or the employer accepts some other record that comes into it, we will adjust accordingly. And all of that is to say that is putting that dispute to a point. And then where it goes from there is through the administrative review process we discussed.
Well, that's educational. Thank you. And I'm glad to hear that when you've got those public employees who need that additional technical assistance, you folks are there for them. That's good to know. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Please continue.
So this is just showing trends of our operating budget expenditures and staffing over the last 12 years. As you see, staff pretty consistent, legislatively approved budget and actuals have gone up. We always like to note that there's a space there between the actual budget and the legislatively approved budget. We take very seriously the fact that every dollar we spend to administer the system is not a dollar that can be spent on benefits. So we are very prudent. I certainly would assert we are very prudent in the ethos we have, which is to say we hold the line on our expenses and have consistently come in under our legislatively approved budget. But we are expensive in relationship to our peers, and I'd like to explain why. It's a very natural question for you through the budget process to ask, Oregon as a system, how do you compare to the other retirement systems around the country? We participate in a benchmarking service that's provided through a company called CEM Benchmarking. And what they do is they compare our costs to our peers. And our peers are other retirement systems of a similar size. And that comparison is international. So most of the clients are in the United States or Canada, but I've interacted with some CEM clients from the Netherlands and from Australia and England and some other places. And it's always interesting to talk to them about what their benefit system does and what their concerns are. The Dutch, for example, are in the midst of, after the 2008-09 crisis, they suffered through that crisis as well as every other system did. They were facing the actual requirement to reduce benefits to their retirees because they had a funding standard of 120% funded. Hmm. So if their funded status dropped below 120%, benefit payments were reduced. So they had to do that for the first time in their history through the course of the aftermath of that. And the discussion and the dynamics around that were very interesting to share and good for us as we went through some of our benefit struggles as well. So what you see here as far as the major cost drivers, the impact says where are we more expensive and where are we less expensive. So economies of scale, we are a relatively large system. We are not the largest, though, so our impact of that economy of scale is we're a little more expensive, 8 cents. Slightly higher transactions per member or workloads. That's having to do with the number of emails and phone calls and sorts of things that we need to address. We get more of those than other people, and I'm going to tell you why. Lower transactions per FTE or productivity. We get hit really hard there. And again, I will explain why, but that's a big driver of our costs in comparison to our peers. We have lower costs per FTE for salaries, benefits, building, utilities, HR, et cetera. Other retirement systems are, at least in our peer group, more generous in their benefit packages and in their pay. And I'm not complaining, I'm just telling you, they are generally those systems that are governed by the board, and the board sets compensation, the board sets the classification, not working through the state agency process that we do. But that's probably a big driver of why our costs per FTE are lower. We're slightly lower for our third party and other costs in front office activities, and then we're paying off also down in the sixth grouping, we're paying a lot more for IT strategy, database, and applications. So overall, we're $25 more expensive than our peers in this comparison. Why? Complexity. This shows the relative complexity of PERS to our peers. We are the dark blue bar, so we are all the way to the far right. There's only three other systems in our peer group more complex than us, and consequently that complexity drives our expenses. That complexity means, to go back, the lower transaction per FTE. That doesn't mean that our people are not effective. It means that our people have to explain a much more complicated outcome. Representative Marsh, back to your point, why couldn't you calculate a benefit? It's just math. You've got three different calculation methodologies. Let me explain full formula money match and the outcome of that to you. And then when we're done with that, you've got 13 benefit options. And if you've had a divorce, heaven help us as far as trying to explain the effect of that. So that is a direct, that one phone call where Wyoming, for example, can send you your benefit estimate on a postcard, we have to send you a 4-page summary of what your benefit estimate is. It's all driven by complexity.
Is there a way to simplify that without taking away benefits?
Co-Chair Smith, the answer to that is the driver of complexity is in the Tier 1 and Tier 2 program. That is where this wide dispersion happens. OPSERP is pretty plain vanilla. Okay. And I've done some comparison as far as complexity based on Tier 1 to 2 versus OPSERP. If this was a chart with OPSERP, we'd be way down in complexity. So to get to your question about resolving that complexity, every provision in Tier 1 and Tier 2, just as every statute in Oregon, has a mother or a father. And somebody thought it was a good idea. Right. So as I was explaining, I think, yesterday or the day before, if you're a school employee and you ask me what's my service credit, I have to ask you 9-month contract, 12-month contract. When did the school year start? When did it end? All of those questions, because school district creditable service is determined differently than state government creditable service. Community colleges are different. So everyone has their own little special niche that they've developed over all of the years that Tier 1 and Tier 2 has been in existence. Could that be resolved? We could take a cleaver, for example, and say, this is how we're going to do the resolution of this question. In that exercise, there will be winners and there will be losers. There will be some people that would benefit. There would be some people that it would not. So We've looked hard at resolving that complexity. In fact, that was one of the budget notes that we reported back to this committee from last time. And because every one of those has a driver, every one of those has a champion, you're going to run into contention anytime you try to resolve it. What's interesting, though, and some of this is just inherent, and the major drivers of that are on the right side of this chart to show you where our score is so much higher than our peers. So PERS is in the left column, our peers is on the right. So pension payment options, for example, we're not all that much more complex than our peers, but multiple plan types and overlays, three programs, puts us to a perfect score of 100. You can't get worse than that, but way above our peers. We also score 100 for variable compensation. That's because we have the variable account for Tier 1 and Tier 2 members, which they could have invested in through the course of their employment before 2004. That means that their compensation varies depending on the return in the variable account portfolio. I'll just skip back up a little bit to COLA rules. This is before the Supreme Court decision. If we don't get 100 in that category, then something's wrong, because now we've got to have the most complex COLA in the country, because it's an individual determination. Everybody gets their own individual COLA depending on how much of your service time is after 2013 and before 2013. Divorce is another area.
Yeah, Senator Johnson, you had a question?
Steve, I presume you've, Mr. Rudman, I presume you've looked at all of these. Are there any of them you can squeeze for any efficiencies if there was a statutory change? I mean, you said there would be winners and losers. In almost everything we do in this building, there's somebody that could be perceived as a winner or a loser. Is there anything that we could find some efficiencies in changing the requirements? Not the judicial stuff. The goal is that's set. But anything else that we could modify? Divorce rules, for example?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, I think my answer to that is back when Senator Strander Hayward was on this panel, I said, first, do no harm. And my point there is, as I said, OPSERP is pretty plain vanilla. And the complexity will wear away as Tier 1 and Tier 2 wears away. Please just don't start monkeying around with OPSERP, or we'll be back on this scale of complexity. So just divorce rules, that's because, again, Money Match is somewhat unique to Oregon, and that is really complicated when you're trying to go through a divorce and split up the benefit and give the individual spouse his or her own benefit. And then lastly, defined contribution plan rules, because we have the IAP component in our hybrid plan, we score higher for that. So that's where our relative complexity comes out. 92 instead of 71. Again, if that was only OPSERP that was being scored, we'd be right around that 70 number. So that complexity explains, again, a lot of what drives our administrative expenses and why they're higher to peers. The phone calls we have with members are longer. The transactions that we have to do are more involved. We have to do, anytime a mature one member retires, we have to do at least two, if not three, benefit calculations just to see which one comes out on top, for example. So that is a more complete explanation or discussion about why it is that we as peers are more expensive. It has to do with plan design and the responsibilities that we have. Moving on then generally to our policy packages. We've just summarized them very quickly here, and I know we'll have more conversations later about the details of these. I just wanted to set them out and see if there were any ones that you wanted to talk more about or that we haven't already covered. We've got just the standard one here about the analyst adjustments, the state service charges, and attorney general fees. This is where our discretionary ones come in. We've got the cybersecurity program. We've already talked about that. And this is one where we're going to have to do more work with LFO staff, as far as once we get this assessment done with our contractor on our current state of affairs and what it takes to stand up an independent program, where are we in the evolution of compliance with Executive Order 1613 and bringing all that together? How do we hook up with that eventual strategy? All of this is to be determined later. 102 is just fully integrating the IAP administration into PERS. Let me cover that just a little bit more. IAP was created in 2004. The legislation creating it was passed in August 2003. We had 4 months to come up with a completely new benefit program. So a lot of the work that we did was offloaded to a third-party administrator. Through the administration of that program, we learned a lot of lessons, one of which is there's only so much that a TPA can do for you effectively and efficiently. So we still have some record keeping and payment functions that are going on from that TPA. This project is to bring all of those completely bring all of those functions in-house, cutting out the TPA, ending $2.2 million a year in TPA fees in administering that, those aspects of the program. Also giving our members better service to have only one place to call for questions and information about the IEP instead of having to go to two different websites, two different call centers, et cetera. This is just a slide just to show you. The red X's are all the steps in our processes that get eliminated once this comes into play. So it's just a graphical illustration that it'll be a more streamlined and efficient process once we cut out the need to connect up and always have handoffs and verifications with the third-party administrator. So that's phase one has already been completed. Phase two has been completed. We're in the middle of phase three, which will end in a deployment January 1 of 2019 with conversion of the system into our own hands. Lastly, business modernization. This is where we're trying to build our platform of technology to be much more robust to support our operations into the future. This is not a transformation. This is not a rip and replace strategy. This is simply recognizing that we built a new retirement benefit administration program that was started in 2004. That project was started in 2004. The design of technology has evolved since then. If I may, back in 2004, these did not exist. Nobody had smartphones. So when we have interaction on the website does not support mobile technology. When we have letters and forms that are generated, they're generated in RTF files. They're not generated in Word. They're not generated in something that modern systems can use and read. So we want to build a more solid platform for us to be able to continue to layer on services and improvements to our members as we go forward and be more agile to reflect the changes that you might make in the benefit structure going forward. So, yeah, there's the picture of the smartphone. Same sort of idea. And this is, again, I want to make sure I emphasize this is not because our current technology is bad or that it's failing. It is because we want to constantly move forward and improve. One of the measures that I showed you yesterday that was in red was those service interruptions and how many service interruptions we have had over each quarter over a span of time. That's because this batch process, which is this outdated form of data processing where we shut everything down to the outside, churn away inside, then open back up again. That's the kind of modernization that we could do, which would allow for 24/7 access for people that want to get into PERS and view their records. And then lastly, data center migration. This is one that DAS added in their governor's request budget. And this adds about $1.1 million for our information services division. We want to plan, design, and deploy a warm site in the state data center, either in its location here in Salem or in our backup site in Montana or maybe even in the cloud, depending on where that actually lives. There's a lot of benefits to PERS in terms of having a second site and having a backup site available. The data center can be a good partner and host in that. This money lets us move forward in that design and configuration of what that next set of backup systems would look like.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative McCombs, Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you talk about possibly in the cloud there. Have you had negotiations with the state CIO on cloud services for the
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Nierman, it's way too early to do that. We're going to, the first thing we have to do is build a platform. What do we need in terms of a warm site? Test it, make sure it's going to be available to us. Then the question is, where does that live? That platform won't be built for another year or two. So by then, you can well appreciate our options may be different than they are today. Cloud services may be, the model may be much more evolved. So that's where it becomes a question. Does that box live in Salem? Senator Johnson points out they're having struggles with power and capacity. Does it live in Montana in their backup site where they've got apparently a lot of capacity, or do we bypass physical at all and go to the cloud? Better to ask that question when you're ready to actually execute on the answer.
Okay, or better to ask it early.
Yeah. So, well, at least to keep it open, at least to keep it in mind, mm-hmm. so you know that there's a down. You're not building to a fixed point, but to possibilities.
So before we move on, John, can we make a note to visit with DAS on how we go about choosing where we are going to locate this type of information? I know there's two Oregon-based companies that have contracted with the state of Oregon for data storage. And I wonder what DAS's policy is on determining how to draft those RFPs up to where, you know, is there preference for Oregon-based companies versus others? I know there's one up in Portland, and I know there's one in Baker City. And the one in Baker City has done a lot of work for the Secretary of State's office. So I wonder at a future meeting we can visit on that.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, that sounds like a good phase two discussion when the state CIO comes back.
Perfect. And I may be way off, but I'd like to ask that. Senator Johnson?
And I'd like to nuance your request by asking for some of the ancillary stuff. For example, Bonneville Power apparently has made representations to some private companies that they can supply adequate power over in Prineville, and now apparently are reneging on that power availability. And so it's not just what makes the most sense, but it's what has the highest durability factor. Mm-hmm. And what all else might be taken into consideration. I've actually visited that site at Baker City, and the state has been in and out of that facility, mm-hmm. as I understand it. I think in order to plan with any kind of longevity, you've got to ask those sub-questions about, you're not going to just capriciously wave this off and move it someplace else when it right. strikes somebody to pull it out of Baker City.
Right. Mr. Co-Chair, if you don't mind, maybe that's an item we can discuss.
Yes, definitely.
Let me just add one more thing to that. We've had some data processing being done by a private company somewhere in eastern Oregon that was for the health authority and has
it's
just...
the same location.
Same location. Yeah. And those 50 jobs in eastern Oregon are a very big deal, and those have been just capriciously yanked back to Salem, and I don't understand why. They're all trained up over there. It's a lot of jobs in a little place. If we really care about rural Oregon, let's not jerk those back and centralize them back in Salem. And you probably know more about that because it's your neck of the woods than I do, other than I'm anguished to learn that those jobs were just with a flick of somebody's finger annihilated, and they're out of work now.
Yep. We'll put that on the agenda, if that's all right with the committee, to have that conversation. Okay. Sorry for the...
That's fine. Actually, that is the end of my presentation for today. I'll turn it over to Linnea if there's no more questions for me.
Awesome. Any other questions for the director? All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
You're up. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair, our co-chair Smith, co-chair Manning, members of the committee, my name is Linnea Whittakin, and I'm with DAS Chief Financial Office. And I'm here today just to briefly go over with you the governor's budget for PERS. based on security assessment information provided by the Office of the State Chief Information Officer, suitable controls were needed to be established to implement, monitor, and improve PERS to ensure specific IT objectives are met. Currently, the agency is contracted with Hewlett-Packard Enterprise to review PERS's information security program and provide recommendations for governing the controls. The deliverable for this review is scheduled for April 2017. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator.
I apologize. I hear the words that you're saying, but I don't understand them. Could you paraphrase what you just read? I just don't understand what you're directing the agency to, or the governor's budget is directing the agency to do.
I don't have the specific report with me, so I'd have to send that to you. It's mainly about finding areas of security where we can make bigger investments.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Is the agency supposed to figure that out? And when you say make bigger investments, has the governor made provisions to have additional money made available to the agency? It seems so sort of open-ended. I don't know who the instruction is being given to or how it is to be paid for.
I think that's a better question for the state chief information office.
Actually, if...
Please.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, this is... more specifically arising out of a major security assessment from about a year ago that caused great concern with the governor's office, chief financial office, CFO office, and LFO. The PERS, as the agency, was given specific direction from those entities to fulfill a list of items related to information security. And part of their actions by the agency to address these major concerns was to hire Hewlett-Packard to do a comprehensive assessment. And that comprehensive assessment is underway. The agency, I think, reported on it in at least in the February session with a small budget ask, I believe, or maybe
September.
September. And so what we're doing is we're awaiting this the outcome of this assessment to make some of the changes in their budget. Is that sufficient, Senator?
Thank you. I just didn't understand what you were saying.
Sorry about that.
Don't mean to be disrespectful. I just didn't get it.
So that is what I'd like to highlight as an emerging issue throughout the budget. As you can see by this slide, and it's been mentioned by Director Roadman, the largest share of the agency's budget is the non-limited other funds. These funds are used to fund retirement benefit payments, the largest being Tier 1 and Tier 2 members, and the retirement health insurance. The number of retirees for Tier 1 and Tier 2 has increased 14% since the 15-17 legislatively adopted budget, and retirement health insurance rose 46%. Also noted on this slide is that PERS does not have any general fund, federal fund, or lottery fund. With respect to the agency's budget category, or by category, 98% of the agency's budget is spent on member benefit payments. 1% is spent on personal services, and this goes to pay for the employees. Another 1% goes to services and supplies. And lastly, just to reiterate, the investments the governor is making in the PERS budget is focused on IT security. Three of the four policy packages that were funded will have a direct impact on IT security. And the fourth final policy package will allow PERS's IAP administration to integrate into their system, eliminating a $2.2 million annual cost paid to a third-party provider. With that, if you have any questions...
I have a couple questions, mm-hmm. and I'll open it up to whoever wants to address this. Talk to us about vacant positions. And I'm not asking for exact numbers here. That's not fair. But have you had a chance to provide those positions that have been vacant for an extended period of time to LFO?
Co-Chair Smith, that's part of our normal reporting, as I understand it.
Right.
So yes, we certainly have.
Are there any outstanding issues on those that we as a committee need to know about?
The Some of the resolution of those positions will depend on the permanent financing plan that flows out of the organizational structure that we talked about yesterday. So if that organizational structure, it has been approved, if it actually gets executed through the budget process, that will resolve some of the vacant positions, like an administrative position that I want to eliminate so that I can classify the other positions appropriately. So those that are open are being held open for strategic reasons like that, and hoping to resolve those either through this budget process or soon thereafter.
And then the one other question I'm going to ask, and I started asking this of other directors, are there any other major significant issues that the co-chairs or leadership, the Speaker or the Senate President, need to know about that we don't know about at this time?
Do you want to handle that one? No, Co-Chair Smith, we have been very deliberative in developing our budget request. LFO has been very helpful in engaging with us, and DAS as well, in engaging with us and how we shape these going forward, and these other priorities we want to pursue. So there isn't, the only issue out there is, what are you going to do to PERS the system? Right. What changes are you going to make through the legislative process? That is obviously an unknown at this point, one that we will have to react to when the ideas coalesce.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. And please know it's not directed at you or your agency in any way. I'm going to start asking that question, and just know that the co-chairs, should ever an issue arise, probably need to hear directly from you, and then they'll send direction to us on how to handle it. But that's good to know that there's no major fire out there other than our $21.5 billion fire that's out there. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Any other comments? John, anything we need to think about?
Mr. Co-Chair, tomorrow will be another short day, but we do have a work session. And so each year, PERS is required by statute to provide a preliminary earnings crediting report to the legislature. And so that will be a work session on that particular report. All the information, including the LFO analysis, is now available on OLIS for your consideration. And I think that will wrap up PERS tomorrow. So thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members.
Perfect. Thank you. Anything else from the committee? We're good? All righty. Michael, we're good?
Yes, sir.
All right. Colleagues, we're going to adjourn for the day.
Yes, sir.
All right. Colleagues, we're going to adjourn for the day.